So this is today. Today is yesterday, and tomorrow is also today.
You traveled through time to the present.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think you get how time travel works.
It's like we're stuck. You know, like a needle on a scratch record.
I wake up every day right here, right in Punxsutawney, and it's always February 2nd.
It's one of those infinite time loop situations you might have heard about.
It's a thing where the same day keeps happening.
Time.
What are you, in a damn time loop or something?
Von Franz, 1980, states that redemption in fairy tales should not be viewed as having religious connotations, but has to do with becoming restored after having been cursed. Such fairy tales do not dwell on the problem, but on the redemption process, making them relevant in therapy and healing. The process is reminiscent of Phil Connor's situation, which is never overtly explained. His story, focusing on his process of recovering his humanness and fellow feeling, which appears to lead his curse being lifted. Banesh, 2011. And that's the start of Groundhog Day Project Day 226, dated March 16th, 2014. Maybe it's not a curse. I'm going to read this one because I was going to read you the scene with Stephanie. I believe the entirety of that scene is in this blog entry, along with a little bit of stuff you heard last week and some commentary I wrote in 2014 and almost to the day. Ooh, I think this episode's coming out on is Friday the 16th. Oh, Saturday's the 16th, so tomorrow. A decade ago tomorrow. Anyway, let's continue. In that second revision, Phil is not self-cursed. He is specifically cursed by Stephanie DeCastro. That's not accurate? Wait, is that in the second revision? Oh my god, I have to check. It is! Oh my god. How did I forget this? For some reason I thought the only way I saw this scene was in Ruben's book. That's interesting that it's in the second revision and not a later one. If it'd been in one of the revisions, I would assume the third or even the final, like they were putting it in to appease producers, with no intention to film it. Anyway, where am I? Phil is not self-cursed, he is specifically cursed by Stephanie DeCastro. And that would have made better narrative sense if she had, I don't know, been in the film after the time loop was in place, rather than her two scenes early on and then no mention whatsoever later. But neither Ruben nor Ramis wanted to explain the time loop anyway. Stephanie only existed to prove to the studio they could explain the time loop. Ramis has stated, I've seen it in a few places but don't have a specific source handy, they never intended to film it. And it's good, because the scene is, well, silly. The scene between Phil and Stephanie is only somewhat silly. But the curse scene is just bad. First of all, the screenplay describes Stephanie like this. There is something vaguely off-center about this woman, not quite fatal attraction, but still a little scary. She interrupts Phil's phone conversation with a guy from CBS, acting like a shrill stereotype more than a character. Stephanie, bitterly, I just want to know one thing. Did I do something wrong, or are you just tired of me, or what? I have to know. After getting off the phone, Phil responds. Phil, kindly, you didn't do anything wrong, Stephanie, and I'm not tired of you. It's just that I don't have time for a real relationship right now. I told you that the first time we went out. Thing is, if Phil is actually talking to someone from CBS in this draft, and the parenthetical there said he was speaking kindly, he's actually not to blame here. At all. And that is problematic for the representation of Stephanie in feminist terms, in characterization terms, not to mention in terms of her role in the plot. Stephanie, getting close. Everybody says that at the beginning of a relationship. Phil, gently pushing her away. I'm different. I really mean it. Things are really starting to move for me now. I'm not going to be doing the weather for the rest of my life. I was just talking to the CBS guy about a network job. I want that. This is just the beginning for me. I can't waste any more time. Stephanie, are you saying our relationship was a waste of time? Phil. Our relationship? We went out a total of 4 times, and only twice did anything happen. It was fun, but I don't see that as a big commitment. Stephanie, closing in again. I had our charts done. My astrologer says we're extremely compatible. There may even be some past lives involvement here. So, Stephanie's a flake, and a crazy flake. Keep in mind, this is her introduction, and she will only get one more scene. Phil's next line is pretty funny, though. Phil, see? So we've already done this. Let's move on. Next case. Stephanie, you know what's wrong with you, Phil? You're selfish. You don't have time for anyone but yourself. Which he told her up front, apparently. I could certainly make a case for blaming Phil as well here, but I think this scene is problematic because it lessens his blame. It makes him less of a jerk and more potentially a victim. And the film version works better because we can easily assume it is all his fault. God or the universe or whatever has cursed him because he's a selfish jerk who really does have time, because he likely doesn't have a possible job lined up at CBS, but chooses to waste it on shallow encounters and rude remarks. Phil responds, again. Phil, that's what I'm trying to tell you. You don't want to be with me. You can do better. Look, Stephanie, if I ever said or did anything to mislead you, I'm sorry for that, but right now, I have to do this groundhog thing, and I don't have a handle on it yet. He throws some papers and his date book into a briefcase and puts on his jacket. Phil continued, I'll tell you what. I'm going to do some serious thinking while I'm in Punxsutawney, okay? He pats her on the shoulder and brushes past her, leaving her standing there with a malevolent look on her face. The problems. A. Phil apologizes, which lessens the argument that he is at fault here. B. This means Stephanie is a crazy person. So C. The entire time loop arises because a crazy bitchy stereotype who it turns out is not only into astrology, but witchcraft, just to make this stereotyping even more problematic, couldn't accept an apology. Or D. Phil is a lying ass who is not self-centered in as casual a way as we know him from the film, but actively taking advantage of the women at work. Note that he specifically mentions how they only had sex on 2 of their 4 dates. And E. If played the right way, his patting Stephanie on the shoulder and brushing past her could make him even more of a jerk. Almost a villain deserving of not just comeuppance, but serious revenge. But then F, Stephanie has that malevolent look, so we're supposed to see her as unhinged. If she were sad, then this would play a little better. But she's not sad, she's angry. That puts the onus on her. Before I get to Stephanie's second and final scene, I should mention a brief bit of what happens between Phil and Rita in the meantime. Outside the Quality Inn, in the scene we see outside the Pennsylvanian Hotel, sure, Phil hits on Rita. He asks her to be my love slave instead of the help me with my pelvic tilt line. But when Rita invites him to have dinner with Larry and me, his response is a little different than the film version. Phil, no thanks, I've seen Larry eat. Why don't you ditch Larry and let me take you someplace nice? He's still hitting on her. Rita, you mean like a date? Phil, yeah. Rita, oh, no. Here's where it gets interesting. Phil, okay, I get it. You're a little intimidated by me. You're all excited about the shoot tomorrow. You want everything to go just perfect. I understand. You just get some sleep. Tomorrow will be great. This bit of dialogue could probably be played sarcastically by the likes of Bill Murray, but it could also be played sincerely. It's written sincerely. There's no parenthetical about his tone, so I read it and I think he's actually being not only helpful, but supportive. This is not a guy who deserves to be cursed. He may have problems, but he is also capable of A, apologizing, and B, being supportive. But. Then, Phil comes across a little worse as he lies to pick up Nancy on day one at the hotel bar. He claims to be the White House correspondent for NBC News. Nancy doesn't buy it, and he takes things too far. At the bottom of page 23, he asks Nancy, so what do you say? You want to play doggy obedience school with me? Nancy, thanks. I'll pass. She gets up to leave. Phil, sit. Stay. He watches her go, then tosses a tip on the bar and exits, somewhat unsteadily. His uncouth behavior there comes from being drunk. That unsteadiness, I would say, subtracts from his badness. Not to mention the fact that he left a tip when no one was looking. Compare that to Larry at the end of the film dropping a tip when he thinks Nancy can see, then taking it away when she turns. Next scene is Stephanie's. Insert. A thick book. The cover reads, 101 Curses, Spells, and Enchantments You Can Do at Home. I know they were going over the top for the scene, but, A well-manicured feminine hand opens the book to a marked page. Interior. Cherry Street Inn. Night. Same time. Phil enters his room and drunkenly tosses his overcoat, scarf, and gloves on the floor in a heap. Interior. Stephanie's bedroom. Night. Stephanie DeCastro, Phil's disaffected ex-lover, is sitting cross-legged on the floor with the Book of Curses open in front of her. Her hair is down, she's wearing a caftan with a zodiac print, there are candles everywhere, and other vaguely occult decorating touches. This reads like a scene from a bad 80s comedy. There should have been an aside here in the blog entry where I pointed out that this basically is a bad 80s comedy at this point. First draft was written in 90, so it's basically an 80s script. Decades are not as distinct in film as they might be in life. And they're not that distinct in life either, just in retrospect. Anyway, where was I? This reads like a scene from a bad 80s comedy, one in which maybe nerds and jocks will go to war with each other or with the dean of some college, and at this point trying to read the screenplay as someone who doesn't know where the story is going. I expect Stephanie to come back into the film later, and maybe Phil will have to discover he really loves her to get out of whatever curse she puts on him. I mean, if she curses him and the point is anything else, then Phil cannot be the protagonist. Well, as long as this is a lighthearted comedy, anyway. It could turn into a serious occult film with comedic undertones, for all I know at this point. Either way, Stephanie cannot just disappear after this scene. Insert. Phil's business card is dropped into a dish. Then the tarot card of the hanged man, a chicken bone, and a feather are placed on top of it. I imagine I was sighing when I wrote this a decade ago. Now even more. When I was in college the first time, I wrote a paper about the representation of voodoo in popular film. I used The Serpent and the Rainbow, 1988, Angel Heart, 1987, The Believers, 1987, and Live and Let Die, 1973. And it didn't go well for Hollywood. The presentation was mostly simplistic and stereotypical, bordering on offensive. If I remember right, it's been a long time since I wrote that paper, and just as long since I've seen any of those four films, the order I just listed those films would go from least offensive representation of voodoo to most offensive. Hell, the Roger Moore James Bond films were all a bit cartoonish, and Live and Let Die didn't even try to present its occult elements as anything that anyone might actually believe in or practice. But anyway, never mind the way Hollywood had stereotyped voodoo and the occult previously, this description right here in the second revision for Groundhog Day demonstrates the worst of it. I mean, I once suggested the specific playing cards visible in the hat scene on God Day in the film held deeper meaning. And I still would like to take the equivalent tarot cards to a tarot reader sometime to see how they look to a professional. But I don't think Harold Ramis knew anything about tarot cards except maybe the briefest of cursory research before he mentioned the hanged man here, just for one fault. And the chicken bone and the feather combined with that ridiculously titled book, that's just bad writing, and or 80s writing. To be fair, I don't think the hanged man is necessarily an inappropriate card for Phil. In the future. Wait, 1911, describes the card thus. The gallows from which he is suspended forms a tau cross, while the figure, from the position of the legs, forms a philfot cross? Philfot? Philfot. I'm gonna go with philfot. F-Y-L-F-O-T. Now I'm curious what that is. F-Y-L-F-O-T. An ancient symbol in the form of an equal-armed cross with each arm continued at a right angle. It's related to the swastika. Because his leg is bent? He'd have to detach it at the knee to do otherwise. That's a weird description, Wait. Wait in this case being Wait from Rider Wait, the, I believe, most popular tarot deck. And the one I own. There is a nimbus about the head of the seeming martyr. It should be noted, 1, that the tree of sacrifice is living wood with leaves thereon. 2, that the face expresses deep entrancement, not suffering. 3, that the figure as a whole suggests life in suspension, but life and not death. It is a card of profound significance, but all the significance is veiled. It has been called falsely a card of martyrdom, which is strange since I've seen a description from Wade that says one of the card's meanings is sacrifice, a card of prudence, a card of the great work, a card of duty. But we may exhaust all published interpretations and find only vanity. I will say very simply on my own part that it expresses the relation, in one of its aspects, between the divine and the universe. That's vague. Oh, wait a century ago. You're being vague. He who can understand that the story of his higher nature is embedded in this symbolism will receive intimations concerning a great awakening that is possible, and will know that after the sacred mystery of death, there is a glorious mystery of resurrection. See? That could apply to Phil and what's coming for him. But it doesn't, I don't think, apply to what Stephanie would think of him in this scene. I would guess someone like her, she's into the occult, but clearly not very knowledgeable. Case in point, the simplistic nature of her choice of books. If she wants to inflict a curse on Phil, and I will admit I'm using an only slightly more knowledgeable form of the silly comedic logic Remus must have used in picking the Hanged Man here, she would have chosen something like the Eight of Swords, representing restriction, confusion, powerlessness. If she were trying to represent Phil as he was, she might have picked the Five of Swords, representing self-interest, or the Knight of Wands, who can represent someone superficial and cocky. But anyway, the scene continues. Phil. He stands at the sink, looking at himself in the mirror, flexing his muscles. See? He's self-centered. Stephanie. Reading from the book, she mutters incantations in a secret language. In brackets, I say, I imagine she's saying something like Cree, Kru, Valgo, Geba, Kalto, Cree.
Cree, Kru, Vergo, Geba, Kalto, Cree!
Bonus points to me if I got that right, and bonus points to you, dear reader, if you get the reference. And listener, I probably threw in the clip, so whatever. Enjoy. That doesn't mean you'll recognize it, but if you do, good for you. Then she sprinkles some powder on the plate. Brackets. A moment ago it was just a dish, that's lazy writing. Then a few drops of oil. Then she makes a few passes over it with her hands, and much to her surprise, the contents of the plate spontaneously combust. My problem here, aside from the simplistic representation of witchcraft, is that Stephanie is surprised by the flames. I would assume she'd expect that. Hell, it seems like exactly what she was going for. Phil. As he crosses to the bed, he accidentally knocks over the suitcase stand, spilling his clothes onto the floor. That his stuff is not all over the floor would be the third loop marker for the audience then, in this version of the story, after the DJs and what he's wearing. See below. He contemplates picking them up for a moment, decides to leave them there, and flops down on the bed. He lies there looking up at the ceiling until the room starts to spin around. Then he closes his eyes and quickly drops off to sleep, still fully clothed. There's the second loop marker. Also, the spinning room could really be Phil's experience from drunkenness or from the curse activating. Stephanie. To complete the spell, she picks up a broken wristwatch and drips it into the fire. I assume that's a typo and it's supposed to be drops. Is that my typo or Ruben's? Ramus's. Who wrote this scene? It's drops. My typo. Oops. Insert. Phil's business card, the Hanged Man, and the broken watch. Not sure about the chicken bone or the feather. That was brackets. In flames. The watch crystal is cracked, and the hands are frozen at 5:59. See, it would have more meaning if the broken wristwatch was Phil's. Like, in some way, when he was having the talk with Stephanie, maybe it hadn't been as civil. He was a little flamboyant, and something somehow... his watch was broken, like there was an argument, and so she ends up with his broken watch, and then uses that as the symbol to make time stop for him. Instead, it's just random wristwatch, which I guess we know it's broken, probably was going to have a cracked face or something basic, because it's Ramus. Oh, it does say the watch crystal is cracked, but it says that after the flames, which she has dropped it into the fire, so did it crack because it's in the fire, or was it already broken? Also, if we're watching long enough for it to be cracked, it's going to get blackened first, and it's going to take forever. This is a mess. This whole scene is a mess. Today's reason to repeat a day forever, to write a film that deals with the occult in more realistic, less offensive terms. And yes, this is coming from an atheist. That's the entry. Just so you know, from The Watch Crystal is Cracked and the Hands are Frozen at 5:59, the script says, dissolve to... close up, clock. The digital clock radio changes from 5:59 to 6 a.m. The radio comes on, playing the end of the Sonny and Cher hit, I Got You, Babe, just as it did the day before. Interior. Phil's room. Dawn. Phil sits up in bed, quickly alert, and looks around the room. Something is wrong. He's wearing pajamas. His suit is once again hanging neatly on the closet door, and his suitcase is back on its stand at the foot of the bed. Again, neatly packed. I still gotta nitpick this part, too, because if he was so drunk that he fell asleep, dressed, and knocked all the stuff down, he might not even remember having knocked it down. He might not remember falling asleep, dressed, and he might not be as shocked by the stuff being neat. He'd be confused and hungover, but I don't know if the specifics would be a problem. But anyway, that's Stephanie DeCastro. Maybe never speak of her again. Although I would love to use her name in a thing. See, she's into witchcraft. She's not psychic. Well, she can, I could have someone into witchcraft. She could be in Death, Death, Death Part 2. Although the listeners to this show probably don't know what that is. That's because you don't listen to the first syllable. You should. Anyway, next time I guess we'll finally get to minute 3. I love this format.
Me round again. I think I have traveled through time.
What is wrong in the end which never comes? Or which comes again and again? Laughing like waves.
Since the Big Bang set everything in motion, everything that happens in this universe has to be the way it is.
Man, are you hungry? I haven't eaten since later this afternoon.
Particles unfolding the way they're destined to.
How do you sleep at night? You've never seen Groundhog Day?
Yeah, you know Groundhog Day is not a documentary.